You are listening to the GeoNiagara Radio Show, sponsored by the Department of Geography and Tourism Studies at Brock University.
Welcome to the GeoNiagara Radio Show. You're listening to Season 2, Episode 9. Today in the studio, we have Dr. Charles Hufstofsky from Brock University. He is a sectional lecturer in sustainable transportation and urban planning. And I had the pleasure of being in two of his classes this year, both which were super interesting and taught me a lot about sustainable transportation and being green and taking care of the environment as in conjunction with planning appropriately.
These were both fourth-year classes, right?
No, actually, they were both third-year classes.
Oh,
yeah,
interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So you've been enjoying the nice weather?
Oh, I'm really enjoying the nice weather. How about you?
I bought a bike.
You bought a bike?
I bought a bicycle. I haven't rode a bicycle probably in close to 30 years, ever since I got my driver's license. For the last few number of years, every time I got my income tax back, I'm like, I gotta get a bicycle. I have to get a bicycle.
That's a good thing to do with your income tax.
And this was the year that I just finally bit the bullet, as it were, and bought the bicycle.
Nice.
And I'm really hoping I rode it here today. It was an 11-minute ride, I think.
That's pretty good.
Baby steps. And I'm also doing it's the Great Cycle Challenge.
Oh, okay. Is this another app of yours?
No, riding. It's riding to fight kids' cancer.
Oh, interesting.
So they have an app for that.
Nice. I knew it was coming.
It's really easy to use. You go to your ride and you log your rides, and it keeps a track of all your kilometers.
Mm-hmm.
And you basically set yourself the goal of kilometers.
Cool.
And a dollar value. To strive for as you ride to your goal. It totals it all up, and then you can extend your goals and stuff if you like to. But yeah, so I thought I'd challenge myself in the summertime in June.
Nice.
It's for the month of June, so
cool.
I thought I'd challenge myself to do.
So you're getting ready early.
I'm getting ready early.
You got the spring.
Yes, yes. to go along with my steps that I do every day. So
yes.
Also coming up, I want to talk a little bit about Dr. Lawrence Stephen, his lecture that he gave it as a historical society the other day. But we'll save that to the end of the show. But first, coming up in June, on June the 5th, between 8:30 and 5 p.m. At Niagara College on the Glendale campus, it's the GIS, Geospatial Management Program, final thesis projects. I've put together a little bit of a statistical summary of all of the projects that have been done in the program since the program began almost 20 years ago. So the total number of projects that they have done in almost 20 years is 373.
Wow, that's incredible, actually.
And by way of a little bit of background on the projects, these are projects that are provided by the community or by private consultants or governments and things like that. And the students need to budget them, they need to set up the timelines, and they have milestones and things like that. So they're always working towards either the proposal or a progress report or the final report. And then what they do is they have to budget the work that they do and see if they how close they come to that budget or if they're over budget or under budget. So the total value of these projects that are provided by the Niagara College students over the last, 19 years is over $9.5 million in projects.
Incredible. Wow.
So just think about that for a second. That is an economic sector right there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the reasons why we do this show is to promote that economic sector.
Absolutely.
That $9.5 million does not include the projects for this year yet because they haven't completed their assignments yet. And there was another 33 that didn't have any cost data associated with them.
Really? But they would have had a whole year's of worth, but no.
Yeah, they would have had. They would probably,
financial.
Yeah, they probably would have been in the ballpark of like $33,000, like between $25,000 and say $35,000 each.
Cool.
The breakdown by project types, and this is pretty interesting. Just over 20% of those projects were done for a nonprofit organization.
Wow.
Whether that was an organization like Geospatial Niagara or an organization like Trout Unlimited,
mm-hmm.
Ducks Unlimited, mm-hmm. Those types of organizations. 16% were done for municipal governments, 14% for the regional government, and 12% for academia. And it goes down from there. Conservation authorities, whether it was the Niagara Peninsula Conservation Authority or Conservation Halton or all across Ontario, actually, that's about 11%. Private businesses is about 9.2%. The provincial government was 7.5%. And the rest that makes up the total is federal government or a government agency, some law enforcement, or other consulting companies.
Wow.
So it was really neat.
Such a variety of projects going on there all the time.
Well, the sectors that they have that are represented in all of these projects, and I really don't want to be just rhyming off a list of sectors, but I mean, it's pretty impressive that the number of projects that they've done, but in the various sectors that they've done them. So you have sectors like wildlife, history and culture, environmental. There's a multitude of subsectors within the environmental sector. So you have the visualization of data, you have land use, you have woodlands, hydrology, water quality, wetlands, streams, biodiversity. You have minerals and mining. There's several geotechnical projects, social services, transportation, asset management, public health, policing. And these are all just absolutely amazing, interesting projects that the students do. And they put so much work into it. So I just wanted to give a shout out to the program this year with the final presentations on Tuesday, June the 5th at the Yerich Auditorium at the Glendale campus of Niagara College. And these presentations are open to the public. So
yeah, I've attended a few and they were super, super interesting.
If you have a particular interest, you can shoot us an email or a tweet or message us on the Facebook page and I can post the schedule for the presentations.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Thank you so much for that information, Darren. I think it's about time we get on to our interview.
Yeah, it's a long one, I believe.
Yes.
Thinking of pursuing a career in the field of geography or tourism? The Department of Geography and Tourism Studies at Brock University offers 3 and 4 year bachelor's degrees and a geography graduate program, each with several study options. At Brock University, you'll get an excellent education with hands-on experience through internships, study abroad programs, co-op, labs, seminars, and more. Explore the world through your studies. Come to Brock and experience the Department of Geography and Tourism Studies today. Check us out at brocku.ca/geotour.
Good evening and welcome to the studio. Today joining us, we have Charles Hostovsky. He is a sessional lecturer at Brock University and a professor in transportation planning. Welcome to the studio. How are you today?
Good, Rachel. How are you? RJ?
I'm good.
Now that you like to be called RJ.
So can you tell me a little about your background, where you're from, and where you have ended up?
Well, sure. I'm from Toronto, originally born there, and grew up probably mostly in the Mississauga, Brampton area and Peel region. I did an undergraduate degree at the University of Toronto in environmental geography. And originally I was a biology major, but I heard that back in the 80s when I graduated with my bachelor's degree that you could only get a job washing beakers with a Bachelor of Science in Biology. So geography looked a lot more interesting, and planning at that point was sort of a subcomponent of urban planning that is a subcomponent of geography.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I was really interested in the environment because I started my undergrad in 1979, and the environmental movement was really starting to pick up, and there weren't a lot of programs in environmental studies. So the geography program at University of Toronto had an environmental major, so that's why I registered in that.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Was there a turning point, or something you can remember where you went, no, I can't see myself doing biology, I want to do geography?
Yeah, I think it was after the first year at University of Toronto, I switched from biology to the geography,
It's
the environmental
so funny.
Geography, and I ended up taking a minor in biology.
I had no idea.
Then I was kind of lucky. I got a couple of jobs, but I ended up at the Ontario Ministry of the Environment, working in the environmental assessment branch, involved in the environmental impact assessment process. And I started working on my Master of Environmental Studies in Planning at York University. And then over a five-year period, I did my master's degree in environmental planning at York. And while I was there, I sort of got dragged into teaching part-time. And I won a teaching award. And I was teaching part-time at the University of Toronto and at Ryerson. And it was suggested to me that I should do a doctorate. And then I think I started a doctorate in 1998. I finished it in 2002 at the University of Waterloo. And I did it in planning, but specializing in environmental planning and resource management. I've been basically taught at the University of Toronto on contract. I've never been a tenured professor. It's very difficult to get a tenured job. But I sort of morphed from full-time planning practice. Previously, I was a full-time planning practice working in environmental planning and municipal land use planning and teaching part-time to teaching full-time. So I was doing a lot of teaching at the University of Toronto. I was actually ended up being there for 12 years on contract with various types of courses in planning and environmental studies and geography. And I got a job offer in Washington, D.C. And I ended up in 2012 in a new planning program at the Catholic University of America, which is the parent, it's the official Catholic University of the Catholic Church of the United States. And so the more famous Catholic school in Washington, D.C. is Georgetown University.
Right.
But they're sort of like parent university is Catholic University. It's not well, unless you're Catholic and American, you don't really know much about this school because they keep a low profile. But when the Pope came and gave Mass 2 years ago, he came to Catholic University and I was there.
Wow.
So they recruited me because I, you know, I was born and raised a Catholic, went to Catholic school, and they were looking for someone to teach in their new planning program and who was also Catholic.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed that, except they had trouble attracting students at $40,000 U.S. a year for the tuition, and they weren't able to draw enough students, so I ended up being laid off before I had a chance to apply for tenure. Academia can be a very cruel and ruthless place to work, and so I ended up coming back to Canada and to Hamilton and got some contract work at Brock University and at McMaster University, where I teaching the past two terms as a sessional lecturer. And, yeah.
So it sounds like you've always revolved around a bit of a environmental role in your careers, but what made you decide to pursue planning?
Well, I didn't really, like a lot of people, I didn't know what urban planning was when I was in high school. And I
was it a newer subject when you were first getting into like your careers and things like that?
No,
or had still been established?
Urban planning is a hidden profession, so people don't really think about it that much. You know, they think more about civil engineering at a city scale than urban planning. But it's really gaining a lot of attention these days, of course, because we're redesigning cities to be livable and to have an ambiance that with a sense of place to we're interested in improving mass transit. And really, since the 1950s, we've been designing cities for automobiles and not for people. Now in the last 10 years, we've reversed that and we're trying to design our cities for people and not automobiles. So yeah, so I got interested in urban planning when I was an undergraduate and decided to pursue the master's and the PhD in urban planning. And ended up in professional practice for quite a few years, maybe a good dozen years, before I ended up in full-time academia. So, you know, in hindsight, I've enjoyed it, although the academic side of things has been extremely difficult. But in terms of my practice in urban planning, you know, I really love urban planning. I think it's really making a difference. And I can honestly say it's really changed. My first job when I got out of my undergraduate degree, and I worked for a few years before I started the master's degree, I was just working on roads, worked with a consulting engineering firm, designing and building roads, widening existing highways. And you know what? That wasn't very fulfilling. And after 2 years of doing that, of just building roads for cars, I quit. And that's why I went back to do the master's degree. But, you know, planning has actually changed. So as I said, you know, just in a nutshell, we used to, since the 50s, we were designing cities and suburbs for cars and not for people. Now we've flipped the coin and we're now trying to reverse that 50 years of bad planning and a design cities for people.
So what is your money back guarantee?
Well, I've been doing this for a long time. The job market in planning is very strong, and I think the growth is something like 10% a year.
Wow.
Because we are, every city, including St. Catharines even, and the region of Niagara, is trying to make cities more livable. We're trying to reverse 50 years of urban sprawl, of designing cities for cars, mm-hmm. and redesign cities for mass transit, for higher density populations, protecting the natural environment. Of course, with the Greenbelt plan here and the region of Niagara official plan, there's lots of environmental protection built in for natural habitat. So, and also preserve prime agricultural land.
Mm-hmm.
So this planning has become decidedly more difficult to do, more complicated to do, requiring higher skill sets in terms of designing official plans and zoning, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And this requires a lot more work. And secondly, we have two other phenomena. We have population growth from immigration coming into the country. And secondly, there's still a movement away from the rural areas of Canada and the United States into the urban areas. So cities are growing everywhere in Canada. So all of that growth requires organized land use and development, which requires planning as a profession to mm-hmm. to organize all of that and the transportation systems associated with that. So I've been giving the students this money back guarantee. And I say, if you follow up your bachelor's degree in geography, the job market is in STEM, science, technology, engineering, math, and medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So a Bachelor of Arts in the social sciences and the humanities, it might make you a better person and a critical thinker, but it's not going to get you a job whereby you could raise a family and pay for a mortgage, especially these days. So as part of moving away from BA in geography to getting into a profession, I give this, say to students, if you do a master's degree in planning from a recognized planning program, because planning is a registered profession. I'm a member of mm-hmm. the Ontario Professional Planners Institute, and I'm a registered professional planner. So you can only practice planning. It's a controlled profession under the Ontario Professional Planners Act. So to practice planning, you need to have a planning degree, and you need to be registered as a professional planner. So because of the job growth, because of city growth and because of redesigning cities on top of city growth, there's a very strong job market. So I've only ever had one student take me back on that. He did a master's degree in planning, and then he emailed me and he said he wasn't able to find a job. And he was one of my University of Toronto undergraduates.
Hmm.
And then he did his master's in planning, a master of science in planning at the University of Toronto. So I asked him to send me his resume, and then I worked with him on his resume. He had a very poorly written resume. So once we fixed his resume and cover letter, and he got a job fairly quickly after that. So I've never had anyone take me up on the offer.
That was Dr. Chuck's money back guarantee.
Yeah. In fact, Anne Marie, one of my students at the University of Toronto, just sent me a little card in the mail a couple months ago with a $40 gift certificate for the LCBO.
Aww.
Because she was one of my undergrads at Toronto, did her master's degree in planning, and she just landed a job at Metrolinx.
Wow, which is the very big, impressive.
Government agency here in Ontario that is putting billions of dollars into higher order transit, light rail transit, bus rapid transit, expanding GO service. Mm-hmm. Of course, here in Niagara region, we're getting three new GO stations. So she's really excited about that. She's working on exciting transportation planning projects to create mass transit, to move people on light rail transit and bus rapid transit in an efficient manner, and to redesign cities. And all of this mass transit that we're building in Southern Ontario, also we're redesigning the cities for people mm-hmm. by increasing population density, job density, making mixed-use developments, with wonderful cafes and shops and music venues and theaters. All in sort of in a mixed-use development that's walkable, that's beautiful, and that has connected to transit. Light rail transit is probably the backbone of most of it.
Absolutely.
So Anne-Marie was really excited that she got this job with Metrolinx.
That's great.
Maybe we should start offering a money-back guarantee for geospatial technology jobs as well.
Oh, that'd be wonderful.
Because all that urban planning needs a GIS guy.
Yeah, well, most urban planning programs require you to take GIS courses, and GIS is a good set of skills to have. It's become, and there are people who specialize, and I took a whole bunch of GIS courses back when it was run on a Unix platform, and you had to learn a lot of code.
Awesome.
And in the early 90s, I was working for a few months for a firm, a consulting firm that specialized in GIS. And quite frankly, I just found it very boring, digitizing maps and sitting at a computer all day. So I can't sit at a computer for 8 to 10 hours a day.
Yeah.
And just not something I can do.
Mm-hmm.
But GIS is a great skill for planners to have, and most planners do have a GIS, because when you work in a planning office, you will have GIS on the desktop, and you'll pull up the cadastral data, that is the information about land parceling, and on the GIS system. So it's a tool that we use.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a higher order GIS skills, you know, like digitizing maps and manipulating data, geospatial data on those maps, there's a job market there as well.
Mm-hmm.
But planners don't do that. We work with the data that the GIS techs have already input into the system.
Mm-hmm. So what was your experience teaching at the college, the Catholic University of America, and living in Washington, D.C. like?
When I was there, I did enjoy it. I was born and raised Catholic, so I enjoyed teaching in a faith-based institution, which was nice. And we, as I said, we hosted the Pope. We had a lot of keen students there, but they just weren't able to compete to attract students into the new program. Living in Washington, D.C., it was a mixed bag. I would say it was a love-hate relationship.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I really learned a lot about American culture and American cities was the effect of gentrification, which is an overdrive in Washington, D.C. So Washington, D.C., it's one of the fastest gentrifying cities in the United States, if not the fastest.
Yeah.
And I was really slapped in the face by it, because gentrification occurs in Canadian cities, but it's not racialized to the same extent as it is in the States. So in the U.S. and in Washington, D.C., you have, and in many U.S. cities, you have large areas of primarily African-American neighborhoods where African-Americans were forced to live under Jim Crow laws. Because, you know, America's a profoundly racist country and a profoundly violent country. And, of course, up until Martin Luther King and then the Civil Rights Act, African Americans were killed and discriminated against. And the horrors committed against them is almost unspeakable to even talk about on the radio. So African Americans were confined in American cities to their own their own communities, and they were forced to live there and work there, you know, and try and get an education there, which of course was very difficult because the schools are poor and they can't afford to. The poverty becomes a cycle of poverty in these neighborhoods. And what's happening in Washington, D.C. is that these African American neighborhoods, as in many other U.S. cities, the African Americans are being forced out, because now all of a sudden the middle class people, mostly Caucasian, but also some wealthier African Americans and Asian Americans, have decided no, they want to live downtown now. They don't want to live in the suburbs anymore, and especially the young millennials. So they start moving into African American neighborhoods like Brooklyn, New York, and Anacostia in the east side of Washington, D.C., and they start to displace the African Americans that are living there. And so the population of in D.C. has plummeted over at least a 10-15 year period from about 69% African American in Washington, D.C. It's now 49%.
Wow.
So there's been a large shift in the population. And then so the African Americans are forced out, and they move into the suburbs. And in D.C., that's primarily in Prince George's County in Maryland. So what happens there is when the African Americans start to move into the suburbs, being forced out of their own downtown neighborhoods, as these neighborhoods revitalize and wealthy Caucasians move in, and other wealthy African Americans, you know, to a lesser degree, they move to the suburbs, and then the white people in the suburbs, they move out. It's called white flight, and they go somewhere else as well. So this is, and Washington, D.C. is sort of a case study of gentrification overdrive.
Right.
So as a Canadian, I was very naive about it and knew very little about it, until I moved there, mm-hmm. and I saw it firsthand. So it's really tragic. And in these African American neighborhoods, you know, they're food deserts as well. They don't have access to clean food. The schools, especially the high schools, are very poor performing with very low graduation rates and low marks,
yeah.
which makes it hampers African American kids from getting into college, even if they can afford college. And I would say, you know, that's really tragic. So I think the Americans have to find a way to revitalize African American neighborhoods, but keep the population there so that they can stay in their own homes without being forced out. And the most recent research now shows that the majority of African Americans in the U.S. now live in the suburbs, whereas previously they lived in the inner cities.
Really?
Yes. Wow. So there's been a massive population shift in the U.S.
Hmm.
And it's a systemically racist. It's just a cycle of racism that doesn't seem to end there.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there's all kinds of violence associated with that. So the tragedy in Ferguson, Missouri, for instance, all revolved around gentrification in St. Louis, Missouri, as African. And then there was the boy, African-American boy, who was shot by the police. So there's a lot of racial tension over gentrification in U.S. cities. And we're relatively free of that here in Canada. We do have gentrification, but Toronto has done a lot, for instance, some neighborhoods to revitalize them, but to make sure that people living in subsidized and government housing get to stay when the new places are built, they're guaranteed a spot.
Hmm.
So that's what we did in the part of Toronto called we talked about it in class.
Regent Park.
Thanks for the reminder. Yeah. So it's not perfect here in Canada, but it's decidedly less racialized than it is in the States. And I think as a Canadian, I'm proud of that.
Yeah.
So the 5 years I spent in Washington, D.C., every day I'd wake up in the morning and I was proud to be Canadian when I saw what was going on around me, especially after Mr. Trump was elected.
A little bit extra pride there.
Yeah, more than a little bit. Yeah, and then he's just a symptom of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Trump isn't the problem. He's a symptom of the problem there, decidedly. There's a lot of work there for planners, though, to solve these problems in American cities.
Mm-hmm.
And they're experiencing the same thing. So the other interesting thing about American cities, let's say like Detroit, some American cities are depopulating. So Buffalo, just across the border here,
right.
and Detroit, Michigan, they've lost more than half of the population. Because of job losses and industrial losses. And this has sort of created a host of problems there. But a lot of money is being spent on new urban comprehensive plans and zoning to try and revitalize these cities like Detroit and Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
So even when the cities are depopulating, that creates a lot of work for the planning profession to solve that problem.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So what have your main passions been through the planning profession and your research?
Well, I mean, lately, over the last 5 years, because of my experience in Washington, D.C., it's been about gentrification, although I have absolutely no training in it. I'm not a social geographer.
Yeah.
But I just, that's been my passion to try and find, but traditionally, it's sustainability and environmental planning and transportation planning and how we can rebuild our cities and suburbs for people and not for cars.
Absolutely.
But this whole gentrification thing is a real conundrum that I would really like to get more and more involved in trying to solve it.
So a little bit about your environmental initiatives. What is greenwashing?
Oh, well, that's a different topic, but
fair enough. Yes.
But that's a very interesting topic, and I had my students examine that in some of my courses I've taught. We just touched on it in our courses here at Brock because I was just filling in for faculty who were away on sabbatical or on a buyout. So I didn't really get, but in a couple of my other courses that I've taught in the past, I have entire assignments on greenwashing.
Oh,
so
wow.
Greenwashing is when a company tries to sell a product as environmentally friendly when it's actually not.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a major study done about 10 years ago, and they sampled thousands of products in the United States and Canada that claimed to be green.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do an empirical analysis of it, it's not actually green. So greenwashing is essentially false advertising. So for instance, you might, in my opinion, one of the most environmentally unfriendly products is bottled water.
Right.
But when you look on the bottled water, there's images of beautiful mountains and scenery. There's the Mobius Loop logo. It might say that the plastic bottle contains recycled content, or it'll say on the bottle it's recyclable, which doesn't mean anything. There's nothing sustainable about drinking bottled water, because you need to fill the bottle 1/4 to 1/3 with petroleum to represent the energy footprint and carbon footprint associated with getting water in plastic bottles and delivering it. Mm-hmm. And of course, plastic is a scourge on the planet now, especially in our oceans.
Yeah.
And we need to get away from plastic packaging altogether. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't break down. It breaks down into smaller pieces in the ocean. So, the government, we have regulations about false advertising, but the problem is that there's nobody prosecuting companies for making false environmental claims.
Fair enough, yes.
So
that should be some sort of punishment
so
for
it's
that.
Or... Really, it's up to consumers to decide for themselves whether a product actually is environmentally friendly.
Absolutely.
And even the term environmentally friendly or green is inappropriate. It doesn't mean anything. They're just euphemisms to give an illusion. So, it's more of a... And the study that was conducted 10 years ago by Terra Choice Environmental marketing firm found that virtually well over 90% of products that claim to be green or environmentally friendly actually are not.
Wow.
So
that's shocking, really.
Would organic be considered greenwashing, too?
No, organic's a totally different... ball of string that has to do with how the food is made, and that's out of my area of expertise. So there are labels, certification labels for organic food. I'm sure there are food manufacturers claiming that foods are organic and aren't, but it's not something
I've looked at. Or sourced environmentally friendly ways, which is often not true.
Yeah,
agriculture is a huge user of water.
Yeah, that's not something that I've really looked into, because there are planners who look at food and it's mostly the health sciences that are looking at that. But that's a good question, a legitimate question, but out of my field.
What does the phrase transportation ethics mean to you?
Well, I think it's not a term that I've heard a lot. I mean, social equity is a term we talk about a lot.
Right.
And environmental equity. And, of course, racial equity. Mm-hmm. And gender equity.
Yeah.
So the best example of transportation ethics, or problem with transportation ethics, there's two things that I like to talk about. One is case in point would be Detroit, Michigan. So half the population of Detroit has moved out of the city. There's vast areas of the city where thousands of houses are being torn down because the areas have depopulated, and they've left behind a small remnant population of African Americans who are poor. So the city's been withdrawing busing services in those areas, and the level of service has been decreasing, so less and less buses coming less and less often.
Right.
And then, of course, a lot of the poor African Americans living there can't afford to drive a car, so they're lacking in transportation equity as a result of this depopulation and the cutback in services. So that's one example. Another interesting example that's local, I would say, is Highway 407, or toll highway. Or the City of London, England, where they have a daily toll charge to drive in the downtown area. So the way that's playing out is that if you're wealthy, you can drive in an uncongested highway, such as the 407, instead of the QEW or the 401.
Correct.
Or if you're wealthy, you can drive in downtown London. But, it's kind of a mixed blessing, because we shouldn't be driving. We need to be driving a lot less. And if you live in downtown London and you work downtown, you don't need to drive. They have an excellent tube system,
excellent
public transportation. So it's an interesting conundrum. On the one hand, it does keep cars off the road. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it does mean that those who choose to practice a less sustainable transportation method have to pay for it. So maybe they should take that money and invest that in sustainable infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
So take the money that we're collecting on the 407 and invest that in mass transit, like light rail transit and subway extensions. But that's not happening, because it's going to a private company, because it was privatized, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So, but I think that would have been the ethical way and the and the more just way to have done that is to take that money. Okay, we'll take wealthier people's, upper middle class people's money from driving the 407, and we'll invest that in the higher order mass transit. But it's not working. I'm not sure what the British are doing with the toll charges they collect downtown. I have no idea. I haven't really looked into it. But it is an interesting subject area. Maybe I'll write a paper on it. And I think we do have some situations here, right here in St. Catharines and Niagara. We have a bus system. It's antiquated. And to a large extent, if you live in Niagara region, you're pretty much forced to have to drive a car to get around.
Yep,
and if you want to do the right thing and you want to take public transit or ride a bicycle, it's much more difficult. So I think there's an ethical issue there, that in that we're not providing more sustainable transportation choices here at Niagara region.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the region is working on that, the planning department and the area municipality.
Looking into the future of transportation planning, what are a few environmental initiatives we can be thinking about right now?
Well, for young people like yourself, I think it's really very simple. I think I wrote a book chapter on this 6 or 7 years ago on what you can do individually. But I think it's really simple for someone like yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, you want to live close to work. Secondly, you want to live somewhere where you have access to higher order transit, subways, light rail, good bus service. Bus rapid transit would be better. And then you want to ride a bicycle and walk. And it's good exercise anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing, as planners, we're spending a lot of time and energy in making cities more walkable and to provide bicycle infrastructure, safer bicycle infrastructure, because we have to make it safe. That's one thing you can do. You can avoid buying a car altogether.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, as you know from my course, buying a hybrid or electric car is not really a sustainable choice. But when you do drive, you want to minimize the amount of driving you do by combining trips, by having passengers in your vehicle, like carpooling. Using your car a lot less. So I go for coffee a lot to a local Tim's close to my home, and I'll ride my bike and I'll walk there. But a lot of my neighbors show up there, and they'll drive two blocks to come to Tim's or to Starbucks. There's a Starbucks I go to. You don't need to drive two blocks. Walk. It'll take you 7 or 8 minutes to walk.
Yeah.
It's good exercise, too. So there's a lot you can do to minimize. And actually, the research is showing that people in your age group are shying away from owning vehicles, partly because of the cost. And secondly, because the people in your age group want to live in downtown places like downtown Toronto.
Yep, it's true.
So my 23-year-old son, he just recently moved to San Francisco. So he lives in downtown San Francisco, and he commutes. He takes the train to his job in the suburbs. He doesn't want to live in the suburbs. The suburbs are boring.
Do you think the education system does enough to teach kids, say, from like a very young age, about the planning process? Like, I know from a young age, like grade two, my son was doing stuff like the difference between urban and rural. But I don't think from the municipal or like regional government side, they do enough to engage the youth in the community with regards to planning.
No, yeah, and I said that earlier in our conversation, that planning is actually a hidden profession. So in grade school, kids are generally not aware of urban planning as a profession, as a professional organization. And generally, high school kids are not aware of it either. Although that's starting to change very quickly. A lot of high school kids are starting to teach it. And planning is becoming a much more higher profile profession. So back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, when we were designing cities and suburbs for cars and just building single detached homes on 60 by 100-foot lots, I mean, yeah, planning wasn't in your face, so to speak. It was, all we did was rezone land for these single detached homes and design roads, you know, major arterial roads to flow the traffic. But now, of course, planning has become a much more higher profile as we redesign cities, and it's become very controversial. So in Hamilton, where I live, the light rail transit project is highly controversial. There's a huge movement of people fighting the light rail who don't want it. And there's a large number of people who are much more sustainably minded who have been fighting for it, and it's been stalled for 10 years. And then most recently, the Ford guy who's running for the Conservatives, who's running for premier, Rob Ford's brother, Doug Ford.
Doug.
So he promised, he came to Hamilton and said, I'm going to still give you the $1.1 billion for the light rail, but you don't have to build the light rail. You can spend the money on anything you want. To me, that would be tragic if we don't build the light rail in Hamilton.
Do you think there's, and this might be a sweeping generalization, yeah, but do you think there's an age difference between, or a bigger age difference between those who do not want light rail transit and those who do want light rail transit?
I can only address that anecdotally from attending public meetings. I have been involved peripherally in the Hamilton Light Rail Project. I've taken my students to a public meeting, and I've attended a rally to support the light rail. But no, anecdotally, I don't think there's an age difference. I think that it sort of spans, three generations. I've seen people for and against it from all age groups. But I think, though, generally, the millennials are in favor of it. As I said, the research shows that they're shying away from owning automobiles and wanting to live downtown, where there's nice restaurants and shops and clubs and music and some kind of life.
Yeah, I find that as someone who goes to a lot of public meetings or public open houses for things like OPAs or official plan amendments and things like that, or regional plans, that it's generally the same 20 people that show up to every meeting.
Yeah, and we know about that. And I have a friend who goes to every meeting in Hamilton, and she went to school with me at the University of Waterloo and did her PhD in planning there. And she's heavily involved as a citizen activist, and that's fine. So I worked for 3 years as a planner for the city of Hamilton and the city of Guelph, and you get to know these people. And I was just actually saying this to my wife the other night. We were watching a public meeting on TV, and I was just pointing out there that and it was in Toronto, and they said, notice how most of the people there, almost everyone is Caucasian. And Toronto's the world's most multicultural city, with 50% of the population is Asian and South Asian, yet there's only white folks showing up at the public meeting. So I said, as planners, we need to be doing a better job reaching out to new Canadians, and to make sure that our public meetings and our public involvement processes, which is a very big part of the planning profession, is that it's reflective of the community, both in gender and in race, and in terms of social equity. And I would say we're not doing a good job of that.
Well, I think that there's a lot of opportunity to take these public meetings, because they're usually held at city halls, they're usually held at libraries, but taking these public meetings out into the high schools to engage the students that are actually going to be the taxpayer in a number of years.
I mean, that's a very good strategy. We need to get to the geography teachers and environmental study teachers in high school and teach, and they need to pass that on to the kids in high school, how they can get involved in their community. Yeah, for sure. I agree. And then the other thing is, of course, is I've done a fair bit of research and publications on this, and there's a whole body of research on public involvement and planning. And in fact, the reality is a lot of these public meetings are what we call educate and cure public meetings. They don't really, sometimes the proponent, including it might be the city or a regional government, I don't think that's the case here in Niagara. We have a really good planning team in Niagara region, but I have seen it in other places where they're just going through the motions. They're holding a public meeting because it's a statutory requirement under the Planning Act or the Ontario Environmental Assessment Act or the Canadian Environmental Assessment Act or various other pieces of legislation. And so they're going through the motions because there's a statutory requirement for a public meeting, but they've already made up their mind what they want to do. So people express their concerns. They might express what they want to see, but then it's just ignored. So, and the purpose of the public meeting is to educate them about the project and to cure them of their dislike for the project. So that's so there's various levels of that. So I see it's less often where the proponent, let's say the city or a developer or a provincial agency, it's less often where they actually will make changes to the plan based on input they receive. But to be fair, the other problem, of course, that we have to weigh is the pervasiveness and how ubiquitous the NIMBY opposition is. The NIMBY is not in my backyard. So as I tell my students, it doesn't matter what project you propose as a planner, whether it's a group home in a residential neighborhood, or a new condominium tower that's 14 stories high, or it's a landfill site, or it's a new station for a light rail or a light rail project, there's always people in the community opposing it. So for instance, I took my students last term to these new public meetings for the GO stations. Well, when we went to the meeting in Grimsby, not too far from where I live actually, there was a large number of citizens there at the public meeting, at the Metrolinx public meeting for the new GO station, and the town of Grimsby and the region of Niagara were there to show the new development that's going to build. So when we build a new GO station or a new light rail transit station, we intensify the development around it. Higher density, taller buildings, 6, 7, 8, 10, 12 stories, mixed use, you know, jobs, restaurants, cafes, shopping, and residential all mixed together. So these people in Grimsby were opposed to it. They don't want the GO station there because they don't want that development. They want to keep a sleepy little town of single detached homes, of upper middle class Caucasian people. And when I talked to one of them who was opposed to it, she said, well, this development will bring undesirables to town. So what did, undesirables? Wow. So because undesirables, and when she explained it, well, undesirables live in apartments and condos. They don't, you know, the good people live in single detached 2,500 square foot homes and drive a Cadillac or a Mercedes. So I just thought, you know, I was humored her and didn't say anything rude to her, but you can clearly see this kind of NIMBY opposition is virtually everywhere. And of course, the strangest one, as I mentioned previously, is the opposition to the light rail transit in Hamilton. It doesn't make any sense at all why we should oppose that. And people should continue to drive in King Street and Main Street and a 4- and 6-lane highway, downtown Hamilton at 80 kilometers an hour. I mean, there's nothing sustainable about that. And it's not even safe to walk in those streets. So that's part of the reason why the planning profession it's been growing in terms of the number of jobs available, because we have to deal with this opposition at the same time as we want to improve the livability of our cities.
I find the planning profession is a lot more specialized now. You'll have like your environmental specialized planner, you'll have your transportation specialized planner, you'd have, you know, your policy specialized planner.
Well, one of the great things about planning as a profession is that most of the degrees are at a master's level, and you can come into the profession with any bachelor's degree. You might have a bachelor's degree in civil engineering and then do a master's in planning. So you'll be more equipped to do a lot of technical work, let's say transportation planning and doing computerized modeling of traffic flows, for instance. So there's a lot of higher tech work in planning. And you mentioned previously geographic information systems. So that's very important in urban planning now. So on the other hand, someone might come into a master's program in planning with a BA in sociology or even in philosophy or in English, and they weren't good at math and they didn't take statistics, or they fudged their way through a statistics course. So, but they have good interpersonal skills and they can run a public meeting and they can facilitate interest groups and work on and help them develop a compromise and negotiate a solution. Or they might have good design skills. They might have a bachelor's degree in architecture.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I found, that if they had offered actually a class at the university level of how to do a public engagement meeting, like a whole course designed around public engagement, that would have been definitely a course that I would have taken.
Yes, and in fact, I have taught courses on public engagement, and I've touched on it in my courses here at Brock. When I did run my own courses, though, in Washington, D.C., I've taught an entire course on public engagement and planning. In fact, when I was a master's student at York, I took a course on it. They had a specialized course in it. So that's how I've done a lot of work in that area, and I agree with you. So one of the things that I have my students do, and I did that with Rachel and my students at Brock last term, is that, and this term, they have to, for one of their assignments, they actually have to attend a public meeting for a planning project. And then they have to diagnose the effectiveness of that meeting at integrating public input into the planning process and tell me whether it was legitimate public input or if it was just window dressing. So in other words, were the proponents and the planners there taking the public's input seriously, or were they just there to educate and cure them, or, you know, a public relations exercise? So I think the students really, really enjoy that.
So I'd like to thank you, Dr. Chuck, for coming into the studio today. It's
no
been a pleasure.
Problem, RJ and Darren, it was a pleasure to be here. I enjoyed it very much.
Well, that was an interesting interview. He's he's certainly pretty passionate about the transportation and the sustainability aspect of it.
He really is. He really kind of drilled that portion every class, and I really enjoyed that part because not a lot of teachers, I think, focus on sustainability enough.
So what was your favorite part of
Right? Definitely his connection between actually music and what he was teaching. So he would actually put in song lyrics of whatever song or topic he was talking about, like "Baby, You Can Drive My Car," things like that, and he would incorporate them into his lectures, and I really loved that. One time he mentioned the entirety of Arcade Fire's The Suburbs album and how they talk about urban sprawl, and he took out lyrics and put them in a slideshow, and we actually analyzed them in the class. That was really, really unique to me, and it was engaging to learn.
Very cool. I always enjoy when educators sort of step outside the norm in terms of curriculum delivery. I just think it just makes it so much more interesting and so much more engaging for the students.
Every student was paying attention that day, I'll tell you that.
So yesterday, Thursday, April the 26th, we're recording this at the end of April, I attended a lecture put on by the Historical Society of St. Catharines by Dr. Lawrence Stephen. We alluded to this at the end of our last episode. The lecture is called Turney's Crossroads, A Portrait Through Time. And this lecture was, this man has to write a book about this because it was very interesting how he took this crossroads that doesn't even exist on the landscape anymore. And he basically started the journey in the 1650s when the Jesuits met with the indigenous community in Niagara. And the crossroads that he was talking about were where sort of the old St. David's Road and Davis Road and Thorold used to cross, going towards what would be the village of Homer, which doesn't exist anymore. So it's basically where Thorold should have been. And he goes through, and he uses a lot of the maps, the historical maps from the Brock University Map Library. And he talks about how, like, the land acquisition and the War of 1812 and all of these. There was intrigue, there was family breakdown, there was all kinds of interesting facts about this crossroads and this parcel, these parcels of land. And at this crossroads, at one point in time, there was a little church, a little German church with a cemetery there. And when the Third Welland Canal was going through, they ended up sort of disinterring the residents, shall we say, of the cemetery, if there were known family members in the area that would disinter them and reinter them at the Lakeview Cemetery in Thorold. What's interestingly different about that time is the government would not pay for that.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. So it was up to the individual families to move their relatives from that cemetery to the Lakeview Cemetery. When all was said and done, there was still about 400, 500, 600 graves that were there, and they just ended up flooding the Weir Pond for the Welland Canal.
Wow.
So underneath that, there is basically a submerged cemetery.
Hmm.
He talked about a lot about the GM lands. If you're familiar with Blue Ghost Tunnel.
I've heard of it. I have not urban adventured there.
which would be illegal right now if you were caught. So, but it was just an absolutely fascinating talk from, you know, we're going from the 1650s all the way up to now. And I think what the real message of that was is that a lot of the land that is over the, around that area was expropriated by the government for the purposes of the possibility of a fifth Welland Canal.
Really?
And it's already been...
And for those who are not familiar with our canals, how many are there?
The current canal that we have is the fourth Welland Canal.
Okay.
And the other three, I don't know the years offhand.
No.
But the land was expropriated for a fifth Welland Canal should the need arise for that, but they've already established that it's highly likely that they will not make a fifth Welland Canal.
Right.
So all of this land, which is would make a beautiful sort of naturalized area and parkland and stuff like that, the push is on to reintegrate that land into the municipalities and sort of divest the St. Lawrence Seaway of that land and sort of reabsorb it back in and then turn it into a park because the archaeological remains of those homesteads are still there.
Right.
And some of the pictures that he showed of the area were very interesting. And I just see endless possibilities for that area because a vast majority of the Third Welland Canal goes through that area as well. Mm-hmm. So you have the flight locks in there. And it was just amazing, an all-around amazing lecture. And if you're interested in history and if you're interested in geography, the Historical Society of St. Catharines, the membership rates are extremely reasonable.
Excellent.
It's $10 for a year.
Nice.
And $15 for a family.
You'd spend that one time or 20 times.
Yeah. And,
it's no problem.
And so I highly recommend it. If you happen to see Dr. Lawrence Stephen doing the Turney's Crossroads, A Portrait Through Time lecture anywhere else, I highly recommend going to that. So you can reach us through Twitter at GeoNiagara. You can reach us on Facebook at GeoNiagara Radio Show. And by email at geospatialniagara@gmail.com.
And I think that's all we have for today.
Our next episode will air on Wednesday, June the 20th, right here on 103.7 CFU. For all of us here at Geo Niagara Radio Show, I'm Darren.
And I'm RJ. Good night.
Good night.
You have been listening to the Geo Niagara Radio Show, sponsored by the Department of Geography and Tourism Studies at Brock University.